As any high schooler can tell you, your social life can have a major influence on the rest of your life, including, as scientists are discovering, your genes. In the last 20 years, researchers have been learning just how much impact the environment and our response to it can have on our physical bodies. Joining me now to explain is David Dobbs. His writing on behavioral science has appeared in The Atlantic and The New York Times, among other publications. And his latest article, The Social Life of Genes, appears in the September-October issue of Pacific Standard magazine. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Great place to be here.
Isn't this science being called epigenetics?
Well, epigenetics is a very broad term that unfortunately has become rather sloppy. So the thing I'm looking at in this article is technically epigenetics, but it's an area that I felt had been overlooked in the broader attention to epigenetics. Epigenetics means literally around the gene, so it's broadly used as a term to refer to anything that affects the behavior of the gene that doesn't involve a change to the actual DNA sequence. Most of the attention so far has been to what changes in the kind of chemical wrapping around DNA that can sort of silence a strand of DNA or let it speak, as it were. And some of those appear to be heritable. What I'm looking at is some much faster sort of cycle of gene response to environment, particularly social environment, in which the big parts of our genomes appear to be responding rapidly to changes in our social environments, which has a lot of implications. It has implications for health. It also has implications really about the importance that evolution places on our response to social environment.
Well, are we talking about changes to the genes themselves or how they behave?
No, we're definitely not talking about changes to your DNA code where, an experience actually rewrites your DNA sequence. This is a matter of whether a strand of DNA is actually doing its work, being expressed, as it's called. There's a term called gene expression. It's really a matter of whether a gene is working at a given moment or not. Almost all the cells in your body have all 21,000 genes. But depending on the cell and the time, only a few of them are being expressed or at work at any given time. We've known that for a long time. But what's newish in this work is that it appears a lot of our genes care a lot, respond very rapidly to our social lives, whether we feel isolated or not, whether we feel safe in an environment or not, whether we feel well connected to others.
You opened the article with an experiment that was done on bees. Why was Gene Robinson's hypothesis that swapping baby European bees and baby African bees into hives would change their behavior entirely so revolutionary at the time?
Well, revolutionary might be overstating it, but it was a bit radical. What we knew at the time, and he started this experiment, if I remember correctly, about 8 or 10 years ago. What we knew at the time from immunology and other studies is that there are situations in which, a substantial number of an organism's genes will react strongly to a change in environment. Your immune system does this, for instance, when a new pathogen is threatening you, is introduced to your body, so that you have a lot of quick changes in gene response and gene activity in hundreds of genes that go to work to try to fight off the infection. So we also knew they went awry in things like cancer. What we didn't know, and what the hypothesis Robinson was testing, is would this happen in response to a change in social environment? And Robinson's been working with bees for a long time and has found out a lot about kind of the genetic social life of bees. What he wanted to see was if he swapped two subspecies of honeybee, would each become more like the other, not only in its behavior, but in its gene expression patterns.
The African bees were more aggressive than the European bees?
Exactly so. He took European bees and African bees. This is referring to their place of origin. And the European bees are of the type that everyone uses for most people use for their honeybee hives. They're relatively gentle, not terribly aggressive. And, of course, the African honeybees are the famous killer bees that are respond much more quickly to a threat and in greater number. Now, their stings aren't any more venomous, really, than the European bee. But the trouble is, there's just more of them that respond at a group level to a threat. So if you were to go up and kick a European beehive a couple of times, you might get 10 stings. You might get 100 if you were persistent. If you went up and did that to an African beehive, you would get many hundreds, and somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 would kill you. So it's the group behavior that changes. And what Robinson had seen, what he had looked at in the African bees was he wanted to see, in a prior experiment, did they become more vigilant as they faced more threats, and did their gene expression patterns look different? In other words, you can do a study of that looks at a bee's brain. You have to grind it up. Looks at a bee's brain and see which genes were more active than before. So in response to some change. So first he did that study, and he found that the more often an African bee felt threat, there are certain genes that responded more robustly and more quickly. So there was this rising arc of gene expression in one set of genes in these African bees. So what he wondered, he also knew what that rising line of response looked like in European honeybees. Now, they would get more aggressive with each additional threat, but not as much so. And so it was with their gene expression patterns. Their gene expressions would rise the more often they were threatened, but not as steeply or as high as African honeybees would.
So they arrived at some kind of a compromise?
Well, what he did was he took about 250 baby African honeybees on the first day of life, and he swapped them with 200 out of their African hive, and he swapped them with 250 European honeybees in their hive, taken at their first day. So there was like a mass kidnapping and swap, right, from European to African honeybees and vice versa. And the question he wanted to see when these bees had finished their lives was, he knew their from prior experiments that their behavior would change, that the European bees would come to act more aggressively, more like their new mates, and vice versa. What he wanted to see was, did their gene expression patterns change? And indeed, they did. When he looked at the gene expression patterns of the transferred bees, the bees that were moved, the European bees that were moved to the African hive and raised to adulthood, their gene expression patterns in response to threat looked almost exactly like the ones of their new African siblings. And likewise, the African honeybees that were moved over to the European hive took on the slower, lower gene expression response to threat that was typical of their new European honeybee hive mates. So this is very interesting, because if you look at these two species, subspecies, they are very, very close genetically. In other words, in their actual DNA code. The main thing that distinguishes they also look just alike. What distinguishes them more is the way they behave as individuals and as individuals within a group. And that seemed to be driven, Robinson found, not really by their actual genes, but by their gene expression patterns, what their genes actually did. And their gene expression patterns seem to be driven, in this realm anyway, largely by social environment. Simply, who did they grow up with? Did they grow up with African bees, they acted like African bees.
So nature versus nurture applies to bees as well. But bees are one thing. Have similar results been found in birds, reptiles, mammals, fish? I know you write about a study on a fish known as the African cichlid. Did they also have a similar response when they were tested?
It was a different sort of study, but what they did show was how rapidly this kind of response can react. Now, as I may have mentioned before, you know, what you are really is less a matter is obviously a matter of your DNA, but it's really a matter of which parts of your DNA turn on and off at different times. So that determines your hair color, your eye color, how large you are and everything. Now, in cichlids, they live in little territories, and in any little cichlid territory, this one species of cichlid, there's only one top male. He's sort of like a pharaoh or the big gorilla. He gets all the sex. He gets better shots at the food, and he looks different than all the other males.
Fish have alpha males?
This fish does. Mm-hmm. This one species of cichlid. And these are not big fish. They're smaller than your hand. But if you're the number one cichlid in your little social group, you have, you know, the benefits of a king or a big silverback gorilla. You get to run the show. You get all the mating and everything. And not only that, but you will be bigger and more colorful.
Well, what happened when researchers removed that alpha male from the tank?
Well, this is what he wanted to know. They knew that when somehow that number two males, right, they knew there was a little hierarchy in this little cichlid society. And then that when a number two male became a number one male, he took on, over some period of time, the greater size and more garish coloring of the number one male. But he didn't know, Russ Fernov, the Stanford researcher who did this wonderful experiment, he didn't know how long this took or if it involved a lot of gene expression. So he just did an experiment. He turned out the lights in the aquarium. He removed the number one cichlid, left the lights off for a while, turned it back on. And over a period of hours, like the time between, you know, breakfast and the end of the school day, the number two cichlid looked around. He perceived that he was now the number one cichlid and very rapidly had like a 20% increase in size and took on all these garish colors and the more dominant aggressive behavior of the number one cichlid. It was like, Jason Schwartzman looking around in the morning, realizing the big office stud had left the ground. And by lunchtime, he looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger. This massive change in what the person, the fish, looked like. When he did further studies, he could see that this was due to really fast gene expression changes that were taking place in minutes and hours, very rapid. Now, the same thing has been seen over the last 10 years in birds, not that massive change in size, but rapid changes in gene expression in broad swaths of the genome, and simply in response to a social signal or a change in social circumstance.
David Dobbs' article, The Social Life of Genes, is the cover story in the current issue of Pacific Standard magazine. The cover says, How Your Friends Get Into Your Genes. Your social life has the power to shape the molecular composition of your body. Plan your day accordingly. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with David Dobbs, whose article, The Social Life of Genes, is in the September-October issue of Pacific Standard magazine. Let's talk about humans. Doctors and researchers have long talked about how damaging stress can be to our health. Why are some researchers starting to think that loneliness is the bigger threat?
Well, loneliness, these researchers tend to see loneliness as a particular form of stress and one that sort of amplifies other forms of stress. And the work I've been looking at the most is from a neuropsychoimmunologist out at UCLA named Steve Cole. And he has been looking at the gene expression patterns of many different kind of groups of people, both if they're undergoing some form of stress and looking at whether they feel connected or lonesome or not and how that affects how the body reacts to these various forms of stress. So he's looked at people, for instance, who have cancer, people who are looking after people, mates that have cancer, young children who have asthma and face different social challenges, a bunch of different scenarios.
Including a study of HIV-positive men that found that those who were lonely or closeted gay men got sicker more quickly than their out or socially active counterparts. And the closeted men also got cancer and infectious diseases more often?
Absolutely. This is what he saw in some of his earliest studies. He was drawn to this oddity that showed up in the early HIV literature that closeted men were dying, getting sick, and at that point dying faster than non-closeted men were. And quite a puzzle. And what he looked at in that study was he confirmed that this was the case. For men who were closeted and trying to fight off HIV, the fight was harder, and they tended to lose it sooner. And at that time, before better treatments, they would die sooner. Likewise, closeted men who didn't have HIV were subject to other health risks at higher rates than uncloseted gay men. Something about the experience of being closeted was causing them an extra stress and putting them at health risk. And the way these and other studies like it led Cole to believe that there's no greater risk factor for health problems than the feeling that you are socially isolated.
If you're lonely, wouldn't that...
that you're lonely.
Well, if you're lonely, wouldn't that also mean that you're getting less social information?
It would. Well, how do you mean social information?
Well, in other words, we're talking about how this has a lot to do with the interaction between different beings. And are genes one of those use it or lose it things?
Well, no. I mean, you have your genes or not, and it's not as if, in general, a gene being activated more often than another will be quicker to respond. That's not really what's at work here, the way it is with, say, neurons, that they do tend to build connections faster. The genes that Cole is looking at are the ones that stood out as being awry in people who are socially isolated were mainly genes that are associated with immune response. Now, this is gets slightly technical, but you can think of the immune system as sort of an attack dog that's on a leash. It perceives a threat, and there's an inflammatory response mounted to fight off the pathogen. And then there's another part of the immune system that curbs that inflammatory response so that it doesn't tear you to pieces, so that your fever doesn't go to 106 and so on. Now, what you were seeing in people who were lonesome was that they were more likely than people who felt well-connected to have inflammatory systems where the inflammatory half of it tended to respond very robustly to stress or pathogens, whereas the modulatory half of the immune system that curbed the inflammatory response, the genes that drove that response were expressed at a lower rate. So these lonely people seem to have an imbalanced immune response to all kinds of stress as well as to direct pathogen threat. And he was trying to figure out what drove that and came up with various experiments. One of the more interesting ones he did was with some kids who all had asthma, and some were well off and some were not in terms of their socioeconomic status. Now, that's a well-characterized thing, is that poorer people tend to have more health problems of all sorts. And so what he did was he looked at their immune responses to different threats. And sure enough, the poorer kids tended to have these off-balance immune responses. But he wondered, what about poverty is actually making this? So he did another test with these kids, or some colleagues did, where they showed them these kids films of social situations typical to their middle school age group, and then asked them a bunch of questions and also measured their immune response. They just asked them a bunch of questions to see how threatening they considered these different situations. They were ambiguous social situations. And the thing that really made the distinction between those who had these off-balance immune responses and the healthier immune responses to their own asthma was not really their income level. It was how threatening they found ambiguous social situations. So it was a matter of how secure did they feel socially, how well connected and confident did they feel in the social world, rather than how much money they had and where their parents went to school. And this cued Cole into this idea that it's really, it's not even when he says socially connected, he's not talking about actually how many friends you have. He's talking about how securely connected you feel to a supportive social group around you, whether that be three people or 30. Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking that this ties us in with another study, 2004 study of 57 children who had been abused. We have very little time, and I do want you to explain that in about a minute and a half.
Okay, I will try to do so. This was a study by Joan Kaufman, a Yale psychiatrist, who looked at 54 badly abused kids in New York, so badly abused they were taken away from their parents by the state. And they, as you would expect, many of them had a lot of mental health problems and behavioral problems. But when she looked closely at what drove them, it was really less the existence of abuse than it was whether these children had someone outside the home, one trusted adult outside the home that they felt they could turn to. And this was social support, as this study defined it. And if a kid, even a kid who had been so badly abused by his or her parents that they were taken away from the state, had that feeling of support by one reliable person outside the home, they were statistically 80%, the chance was 80% statistically that they would not suffer the kind of mental health problems that the abused group as a whole did. So it was like a partial inoculation against a terrible upbringing that the social support seemed to bring these kids. Now, it's easy to make too much of that kind of study and say something stupid like your upbringing doesn't matter. Clearly, the best social support is the family. But it does drive home how vital social support is when it can be its lack, in effect. What this study showed was the lack of social support can be almost as toxic as a home in which a child is badly abused.
In 30 seconds, what do these studies mean for the age-old debate of nature versus nurture?
Well, I think it really shows that that debate really needs to be set aside and that we need to recognize that it is always both. What these quick gene expression responses to life show is that nature meets nurture inside the cell where the gene responds to the outer environment. It's not an either-or thing. It's a constant conversation between gene and the environment. And the product of that conversation is you.
David Dobbs' article, The Social Life of Genes, is the cover story of Pacific Standard Magazine, the September-October issue. And I thank you so much for being on our show today, David. It's been fascinating. There's a lot more that we couldn't get to, so I suggest that people check out the article.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being with you.